It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. Going to start off with my day. Had a good day. Had a pretty good day. A lot of good things happened. Finally decided on the vehicle to purchase. Went with the iconic Jeep Willys Unlimited. It was kind of a frustrating day a little bit. And yes, frustrating is now a word. A little flustered, a little frustrated. Come together. A little bait and switch tries, but that's when you're dealing with car dealers. You get that stuff kind of every once in a while, but found one that I like. Because look, I've always wanted a milk crate on wheels, and given the realities that are going on in the world of manufacturing today, it was by far the best choice, and I'm thrilled with it. An American-made product, union-made product, because that's where my mind is. Look, as a working person, I want to promote and support my neighbors, my friends, my community. That seems to be in this weird moment. And this is one of these, there are some who, because of whatever political bent that they have, somehow this is bad. Oh, you know, when Donald Trump said country first, I'm going, no, I'm buying products. I'm using my dollars to buy products that I think are going to keep people employed. Because that's how my mind works. I'm going to buy, first and foremost, if there's something on the shelf, I flip it over, check the label, where was it made? Was it made in the U.S.? Leg up. Was it made by union workers? Double great. That's probably every time what I'm going to buy. Made in America? Yeah, I'm going to buy that. Made in a foreign country by union labor? Probably going to buy that. And this is one of those ones where I struggle a bit. Because to be honest, there are a lot of American companies that don't treat people all that well. And a lot of foreign companies that are owned by foreign people who their employees get treated really well. So I struggle with that a little bit as a union guy, because I think every worker should have a voice on the job. I think you should have some say in what happens to you where you spend a good portion of your life. And I think you should be able to make a good, reasonable wage. Doesn't seem all that hard to me. This seems now to be, in this moment, we're polarized, we're in our camps, we've got our flags, and we have decided that now somehow this is polarizing, that this is wrong. And it's kind of bizarre that we're in this spot. Now, like I said, you know, I'm looking for union-made, American-made, first and foremost, bang. And then I'm looking for American-made. For instance, I'll give you a perfect for instance. My wife has convinced me with some shoe busting that I need floor mats. I need better floor mats than those little carpet ones they give you. I actually need to cover everything. Because look, I'm really hard on stuff. I use stuff. And look, I do a lot of really, you know, physical stuff. I'm dirty a lot. I'm greasy a lot of times. I do hard physical work. And I'm rough on things. It just is. And look, I'm a big guy, so I'm rough on things anyway. But she finally convinced me, no, you've spent a lot on this, and you need to keep it like I would, like someone just bought it, and you could eat off of it. So I decided on American-made floor mats. They're not union-made. I wish they were. I wish there were union workers who made them. If I could find them in this country, I would buy them. And if someone knows, please let me know, because I can't find ones that are made in the U.S. by union workers, because I believe in the power of we, the working people, to use our dollars, our spending, to promote good jobs. What's wrong with that? I know, but the former guy. You know, for me, whose jobs are we going to save today with our purchase tomorrow? You know, how many people, you know, are going to keep their job because people think like I do? Hey, I want to support my neighbors. I want to make sure that the job that I save, oh, I don't know, could even be my own. And we talked about it yesterday, how Henry Ford, you know, wanted his employees to be able to buy the product that they were making. doubled their wages. Now, sped up the line and did a lot of horrible stuff. But still, hey, wanted to make sure that they could buy the product. Now, this isn't because he was good. He was a good-hearted guy. It's not because, oh, he cared about those poor people. It's because he's a capitalist. He goes, we need people buying stuff. And, you know, I look at the fact that I went through this a little bit yesterday of, you know, where some of these cars are being made by people working in poverty conditions, low wages, desperate conditions, you know, no say on the job whatsoever, exploitable, you know, disposable. And you go, that's not right. And especially when you look at the fact that the cars aren't that much cheaper when they're made in those areas. So for me, I want to make sure that there's a fair distribution of the wealth that's created by those cars that goes to the workers. And as I said, you know, I had a bunch of Trump people, you know, chiming in. Well, when Trump did this, what? I was behind him 100% when he said, hey, we're going to bring manufacturing back to the U.S. I was 100% behind him when he said, hey, we're going to recreate the golden age of manufacturing. I was behind him 100% when he said, hey, we're going to use tariffs on China. Now, the problem was, and I got to be honest, this is one of those things where his rhetoric was there. So Trump supporters, this is one of those moments you go, this is where we can agree on things. This is where we can reach across the aisle a little bit because we agree. That's right. We agree. Now, where we don't agree is you say he went and he did something. I say he had a lot of rhetoric, but to be honest, his actions were terrible. They weren't thought out. There was no real plan or agenda. It was whatever he felt like at that 3 o'clock tweet. We need an actual plan. And a big part of that plan is back to us. I blame us. I blame we, the people, for most things that go wrong because we're so easily divided and torn apart. When we can't agree that we're going to buy a product that's made in the U.S. because it's going to help our neighbors, it's going to help our communities, it's going to help our country because we're going to be able to keep tax base here, we can keep jobs here. When we can't agree on that, there's a problem. And this is where I'm hopeful in this moment that we wake up. And look, I had a really good moment today. We were all over the place looking for the thing that we wanted to buy, which is getting much more difficult because of the shortages and the supply chains that are spread out all over the globe. Look, as much as I love the Jeep, only 60% of its components are made in the U.S. The rest of it's made in Mexico or Japan or somewhere else. Our supply chains are way too far, way too thin, and way too hard to get back here to keep people working. And look, had a couple people reach out and say, oh, you know, look, we work in these plants. We don't have the parts because we've allowed the supply chain to be all over the world. And yeah, I do think we need to have a very strong supply chain. And if you call me nationalistic or jingoistic, because I think we should be able to produce things, I'll take that from you because I think it's important, extremely important, not just for consumers, but for national security. The fact that we can't seem to put things together right now is kind of scary. And talking with the guy who owned the dealership where we bought the car, and I got to tell you, great guy, never thought in a million years. This is one of those moments where I try not to judge people before I talk to them. I really try not to. But this gentleman, he got me. He got me today. I was expecting, you know, off onto the fringe because we were up in really rural country. And I was expecting, you know, this gentleman to be, you know, big Trump supporter and, you know, and maybe even get into some kind of argue scenario. And I wanted none of it. I wanted to buy my car. I wanted to go on. And, you know, at one point we started talking, and I forget what it was, but the conversation then turned into people wearing masks and how ridiculous it is that people aren't protecting themselves. And I was like, oh, my kindred soul, my brother. And it was this weird thing where I know in rural communities there are sane, rational people. I know in rural communities, it's not all rabid Trump supporters, even though that's who you run into most often because they're the loudest. And, you know, in talking with this guy, he's like, you know, I had to stop going to church. I had to stop going here and there because nobody is protecting themselves. And to listen to him talk about living in a rural community, being, you know, a business owner and a pillar of the community, you go, there's got to be a way to reach folks. And I'll tell you, there's part of me that goes, maybe it doesn't happen. Because some of the stories he was telling, you know, someone that he knew, you know, well, died from COVID. And nobody around him, his own brother didn't get vaccinated. They held a funeral in the front yard where nobody showed up with masks. And I go, how do you go to a funeral during a pandemic with someone who died from whatever the pandemic was? Oh, I don't know, COVID. And not try and protect yourself from what put him in the box. It's really bizarre. And this is one of these moments where I want to find common ground in these communities. I want to be able to understand the rationale. Because, you know, it came up with the whole, you know, the drug cocktails and the Joe Rogan thing. We're going to throw the kitchen sink at it. Well, when the simple reality was you could have just gotten the vaccine and it would have been, you wouldn't have needed a kitchen sink. I mean, it's really kind of twisted. But I'll tell you, it left me leaving, you know, today going, there are people who are in those communities who are trying. And they're, the hope is, and this guy was really positive, and I loved that about it. He's going, look, you know, things seem bad, but we'll get by it. Things seem like they're too far gone. We'll pull it back. You know, the reality that he believes the people around him are good people, and I do too. I think they're on this weird kind of whatever drug that's out there, or maybe it is the horse warmer drug. I don't know. Or it's, you know, just tons of misinformation. But I'm looking for this moment where how do we pull a country back together? How do we pull people back together to where we come to at least, you know, you're never going to all be on the same base, but at least in the same stadium, at least watching something of the same game and not be in a world of everyone has their own facts, not opinions. They have their own true, heartfelt, sincerely held beliefs that these are absolute God-fearing fact. When the reality is it's something they read on Facebook or saw on YouTube. Now, I'm like this guy. I would love to take some of the passion for his community, some of the positive thinking that tomorrow will be better, that people will eventually come around, that eventually we get our hands around this, and eventually we get past it so that we can get to the other side and we can heal and we can move forward. I don't know. I'm not there yet. I want to be. There are issues I think that can bring us together. And look, I think jobs and trade and all of that are part of it. And I think there's an education process. Because even this guy was like, so you're not going to buy this truck because it was made in Mexico? And I go, no. I want those jobs to be here in our country. And the only way we make those companies bring those jobs back is if we don't buy their products. I am a firm believer in domestic production for domestic consumption. You want to make cars in Mexico for the Mexican market? You go right on ahead. You want to make cars in China for the Chinese market? You go right on ahead. But you're not going to make them in China for pennies on the dollar and bring them back here and line the pockets of the billionaire class even more. Sorry, that's not going to happen. And this is where working people in this country have got to say enough is enough already. We've seen the numbers. We know what's going on. And every day it's getting that much harder. Every day you're looking around going, hey, what do we make? I would love nothing more than to be able to find a car that's made entirely out of U.S. parts. Because you know what? When they were, I don't know. I thought the parts were a lot better. But we're in this world, and I'm hoping the pandemic has awakened some eyes to this idea that we are spread too thin, that we are too dependent on the rest of the world. Now, look, I get people all the time who go, well, no, that's what's going to keep the peace. And the American way has always been, and I love the George Carlin bit, where, you know, they go in, they start a war and whip a little industry on them. Because as Carlin said, those are the two letters in the word industry, U.S. Go in, exploit some workers, make some profit. This way we hang around. We have our military there to protect our interests, and our interest being corporate. Another reason why I'm not in favor of being in countries all around the world. Because I don't know what interests of mine they're protecting. I know they're protecting giant multinational corporations. And we pay for it. With trillions and trillions of dollars that could be invested right here in infrastructure, that could be invested right here in healthcare and education and all the things that made this country truly great. So when I do hear the jingoism of Trump going, make America great again, or I hear the MAGA hats running around, you know, spouting the talking points. Think about where the money went to people like Trump. And then ask yourself, when these tax cheats, because remember, you know, Trump was saying, hey, of course, I'm smart for not doing it. And the supporters said, yeah, he's smart for not paying his taxes. He's smart for not allowing us to invest in our country. At some point, we got to wake up to this. And this isn't for me a right, left, Democrat, Republican, liberal, conservative thing. It's an American thing. We all need jobs. We all need to support our kids. We all need good quality health care. We all need good educational institutions so that our kids can have a better future and a better chance. We all need these things. And this is where, you know, in talking with this guy, the same thing. I mean, here was a guy who just wanted the best for his family, working his butt off, trying to live the American dream. I think a lesson for all of us. Now, for me, if we could just throw in a little bit of, hey, I do care where things are made, maybe be a better place. Love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. Nothing more American than workers standing up, and the union gives a voice to win. On the Rick Smith Show. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1965. That was the day the Delano grape strike began in California. The strike came a year after activists had forced Congress to end the Bracero contract labor program. The Filipino Agricultural Workers Organizing Committee, led by Larry Itilong, Philip Vera Cruz, and others, called the strike against the Delano growers and the Coachella Valley grape growers. It had been a record harvest. Farm workers demanded higher wages, humane working conditions, and union recognition. When the growers refused, thousands walked out of the fields. A week later, the Mexican-American National Farm Workers Association, led by Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huerta, joined the strike. It was a historic moment. Within a year, the two unions would merge to form the United Farm Workers. The union sent strikers to the Oakland docks to persuade the longshoremen not to load non-union grapes. Many of the Filipino workers in the San Joaquin Valley worked in the Alaska fish canneries organized by the ILWU in the off-season. And so the ILWU honored their union brothers' request. Thousands of cases of grapes were left to rot on the docks. This initial victory led Chavez to organize a grape boycott against heavyweights DiGiorgio and Shenley Industries. 6 months into the strike, union leaders marched 300 miles from Delano to Sacramento to bring attention to their struggle. They hoped to pressure growers to the negotiating table and legislators to act on their behalf. For 5 years, the strike and boycott continued with marches, organizing, and picket line arrests. Gradually, the UFW began winning higher wages, union recognition, and hiring halls. Finally, in 1970, a collective bargaining agreement covering 10,000 workers was reached.
Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, looking forward to some big fun. On Thursday, because according to the Ohio Senate President Matt Huffman, the Senate Republicans are going to unfurl their creative mapping of Ohio's House and Senate districts on Thursday, September 9th. And, oh, I can't wait to see what this is. Now, as I understand, constitutionally, they have to do it by September 15th. So there's not really a lot of time to judge the creative mapping because, after all, how many districts are there? They're like, I think, 99 House seats they've got, 33 Senate seats. So you've got a handful of days to look at all of these creative maps. Oh, I can't wait for the cartooning. Should be quite fun. But hey, they're going to be dropping the ball so we can get a good whiff of what the GOP is dropping. Because look, we're famous for gerrymandering here too, but we'll see. And here to share some thoughts on what tomorrow could look like and what these creative maps might look like as well, I've asked Susan Tebben to come talk with us. Susan's a reporter over at the Ohio Capital Journal. She's one of the folks paying attention to this. You want to check out their website, ohiocapitaljournal.com. We'll get links out on social media. Susan, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me.
So am I getting this right? I kind of got the numbers right. Tomorrow, the big drop. A couple of days is when they couldn't wait another day to get this out of. Am I getting this right?
Yeah, you're getting this right. And they literally couldn't wait another day. So they have to, after they approve whatever map they approve, which could be tomorrow, could be another day, they have to have constitutionally 3 public hearings on whatever map they decide on. So they have to decide when that's going to happen. We're hearing that might happen Sunday through Tuesday. But we'll see. We can't get that confirmed yet. So that's something else that has to happen before September 15th. And then we have to look at legislative districts versus congressional districts and do all that.
All that stuff. So I got to tell you, when I saw this and I saw that you had to have 3, I'm going, okay, well, you have one hearing during the Ohio State game. Have one hearing during, you know, when the Browns and the Bengals play. Yep. Have one, you know, hearing during Monday Night Football. This way we can get all the target demographics that would be, well, ignored.
Yes. Are the Indians playing still? I'm not sure. So that we could have one then, too.
No, but, you know, this is one of those things where you go, you know, you guys in Ohio tried to stop some of the gerrymandering, passed some stuff to help with this. With this redistricting commission that evidently where they're supposed to hand these over. This wasn't supposed to be how this played out, was it?
No, absolutely not. No, there was an entire ballot initiative because of what happened the last 10 years ago when it was literally a secret suite at the Sheraton Hotel or at a hotel next to the State House where Republicans met and they put together maps that they felt worked for them. And then came out and said, here's the maps. And there wasn't a whole lot of time for public input. There wasn't a whole lot. It sounds very familiar. There wasn't a whole lot of time for public input. So we're going to do this. But we didn't have this. What we have now is a ballot initiative, which makes this commission exist and also makes it so that there are certain things that you have to do to include the public in this. And there are certain bipartisan issues. You have to have members of each party on this commission and you have to allow for bipartisan agreement. So if they get bipartisan agreement, we can have the 10-year maps. If they decide they don't have time and they want to pass, which they can, a majority Republican approved map, that will be a 4-year map. And we have to do all of this again in 4 years. So there's different methods to this madness now.
Okay, so if they continue to control things as they have when they create their own maps and they choose their own voters, they can just keep doing this every 4 years to hold on to power as opposed to doing anything in a bipartisan fashion. That seems rather tricky.
It's a little tricky. And believe me, the League of Women Voters, the ACLU, all on the line, they've all said they're ready and willing to go to court for this. And frankly, they're expecting that they will go to court over this. So I think we're going to see a lot of playing in the courtroom over this. Supreme Court will have to have a say before we decide this fully. We have, and we still have to decide the congressional district, so we could be into November doing this.
Yeah, from what I've read, and you guys have been doing some great reporting on this, from what I've read, they claim they've done nothing, but they've got to the end of the month to get that. These are the state houses, the 99 state house seats, the 33 Senate seats, that evidently there was supposed to be a September 1st hearing that didn't quite happen. Because what I read, and help me if I'm wrong, it's because the census was so badly screwed up that the last administration really boogered up badly that they're then claiming, well, we couldn't do our work because, well, how does that work?
That is what they're saying, yes. So because of the census delays that we had, it set them back from getting the data that they needed to draw the maps. So they the Republicans, at least on that side, say this is why we couldn't do this. This is why we couldn't. But you have Democrats, Senate Democrats have already, the Senate Democratic Caucus has already released a map that they proposed. They released that September 1st. So it wasn't exactly, you know, with a whole lot of time there, but at least the Democrats specifically did it saying, here, we can prove that you can put out a map. So you have both sides saying this could have been possible. We could have been preparing for this for 7 months, even if we didn't have the data. But the GOP says we didn't have the data. We didn't have enough time. So we'll have to figure this out in this extremely short timeline. And they had that trigger. September 15th is the new deadline. And that was actually built into the ballot initiative as a trigger. If they couldn't decide on anything by September 1st, it just didn't seem like that was ever in the cards for this based on what we've seen so far.
Yeah. So what are we expecting out of this? I mean, you know, we've seen these maps, you know, before. I mean, you know, North Carolina had some really creative ones. Pennsylvania had a lot of really creative ones. In fact, the senatorial district that I live in currently looks like that Calvin kid who's usually, you know, whizzing on things, only he's got a really bad case of gas. And I happen to live right in the center of the gas cloud of the 30th senatorial district here in Pennsylvania. And good look, you know, hey, there was a nice joke. It was funny. Ha ha. But not really representative of compact, contiguous, and of the district.
Right, right. No, we have so many districts here. We had last week a whole week of testimony from public people in the public saying, we can't stand how these districts are drawn. We have the snake on the lake up in northern Ohio. We have, it's either called a duck or a dragon in central Ohio. We have any number of names. We've got names for everything for the districts here that say our neighbors down the street are in a district, different district. We have houses cut in half that on one side of the house, it's a district. On the other side of the house, it's a district. And they go to vote and they think they're educated. And then they say, never mind, you're going to another district. So there's those issues here. We certainly have these issues that we have to iron out. No, and there's the idea of constitutionality of it all,
yeah,
too.
And this is the weird thing here is that, you know, I go, you know, from the beginning, you know, why is it that politicians are the ones who are dealing with this? I mean, you know, Ohio did the vaccine lottery. Why don't we just have a lottery and whoever wins the lottery gets to draw the map? You give them a crayon, you give them the MacBook, go to town.
We've had middle school students. Yeah, middle school students. There was a contest for middle school students to draw maps in Ohio, and they did it. And you know, they weren't horrible. I don't know the constitutionality of it because that was pretty early on. And we've had many, many. You can look on the Ohio Redistricting Commission's website and you can see all of the public maps that have been drawn by people, professors and people that do this for a living. And they say, you know, this isn't this hard because there's software now that will basically do it for you.
Right. So this is one of these things where I am personally not 100% against the idea of gerrymandering. It's the aims that I have a problem with. If we could get 50-50 districts to where we're now really talking about ideas and people are really competing on who's got the best plan, who's going to, you know, invent the next, you know, monkey widget or whatever, then I'm okay with, you know, fiddling things around a little bit. But if we're making safe districts where the incumbent's never going to lose in a million years, even if you do find a dead hooker and a live boy in the trunk, there's a problem there. And I don't want that for either side because it's not good for voter participation. So many people go, what is it? I live in central Pennsylvania. There's no reason for me to go to vote because there's no way a Democrat's going to win in the gerrymandered district that I'm in.
Right. You certainly don't want people starting to think that. And there are people that think that. I don't need to vote. Why would I vote? I know the Republican's going to win, or I know the Democrat's going to win,
right,
depending on where you are. Yeah, no, that's definitely, it affects voter access. It affects everything that, you know, the very idea that voting is going to change things gets, you know, convoluted when you have districts that don't seem to make sense. And you have rural districts mixed in with urban districts, and they don't have the same, you know, interests or even people in them. And then you have the prisons being counted as, in the census, being counted as they live in those prisons. So that goes back and adversely affects the communities that they used to live in, which, you know, can upset a whole lot of things. So yeah, there's a lot of things that are impacted by gerrymandering, good or bad.
Yeah. So now you're going to be following this, obviously, tomorrow. And what do you expect? I mean, this, you've been doing this for a little while. You kind of have a sense of what you're expecting tomorrow. Do you have any sense?
Yeah, I mean, I've certainly talked to people that have done this for the last 10, 20 years. And we've seen what we expect is the GOP is going to put out a map. And, you know, with the Ohio legislature, it's never, this is going to happen. We always have to lean on the side of this is probably going to happen. But we're expecting a GOP map, and it's supposed to be a House and Senate GOP map together, whereas we just got a Senate Dems map. So we don't know if we're going to get a House Dems map. And then they're planning on introducing that in the morning. So they're having two meetings tomorrow, one at 10 a.m., one at 2 p.m. And then the 2 p.m. might be when they actually pass through a map that they say, this is the map that the commission thinks is the best. And then that starts a process of the 3 days of hearings that are supposed to be on three different days. So hopefully that will still happen.
So that, but, that kind of explains it, because, you know, this is the, like, you're, this is like the ticking, you know, the ticking bomb. We're getting down to the 24th hour here, that right, there's no right. more time for them to stall or delay. This is it. There's almost a gun to their head going, you got to get it out.
Right, or they have to do what they've done on budget cycles, which is cover the clock over and say, we don't know what time it is. And then once they're done with this, they can't even sit on their laurels, because congressional districts come after that. So we have to start this all over again.
So this is one of these things, Susan. And it, look, you know, if Democrats were this blatant about it here in this state, I would be screaming from the rafters, because this isn't how this is supposed to work. This isn't how the democratic process is supposed to work. How is it the people in Ohio are going, eh? Is there outrage, or are people just going, eh, we're dependent?
Oh, no, there's definitely outrage. And it's interesting, because it's kind of bipartisan outrage, because when we had the meetings, the redistricting commission went all over the state. They had meetings at universities in Lima, the Ohio State University in Lima. They had some in Zanesville at OU's campus in Zanesville. They had them all over, but the people that didn't agree, that they denied that gerrymandering was happening, but they also said you shouldn't be having these meetings at universities. You should be having them at trade schools. You should be having them at community centers and things like that. So even they had an issue with how these were going. And then you have general outrage on the other side, which is, you know, this should not be happening in the state. We had a ballot initiative that said we didn't want this to work this way. Why is it still not transparent? Why is it not still working the way it's supposed to? You know, you have the GOP. I will say, I have to say that the GOP denies that they're doing anything in secret. Besides, they're meeting with their staff or meeting to sort of talk about maps, but nothing's being decided. So I have to say that, or I wouldn't be doing my job.
No. And I don't want you taking sides. This isn't a, this is, let me do that.
Yeah.
Let me be the one to go, I think I know which way they're going to go. They're going to hold on to power, because absolute power corrupts absolutely. That's a universal truth, no matter which side of the aisle you're on.
Right. And it would be a logical thing for them to do, is to want to keep what they have.
Absolutely.
It's
so
working.
Most certainly, if you give me the magic wand to where I'm going to win every time, I'm going to win every time. I'm going to tell you that right out. I'm not benevolent. I'm not wonderful. I want to win. And they do too, which is why this shouldn't be in their hands.
Yeah, we had a professor that came to one of the meetings and said, they win whether you flip the coin or whether the coin lands on the edge. They still win. That's how people feel, yeah.
No, and this is one of these things where you go, I look at Ohio. Ohio isn't a 100% red state. And yet you've got you got veto proof majorities, right? I mean, you've got super majorities everywhere. And Ohio is not a 60-40 state. You know, maybe 53-47, maybe somewhere in there.
Not there, yeah. And that's a big argument for people that are on the side of, we need to get rid of gerrymandering. It's, this is a purple state. That's what they keep saying until they're blue in the face, is this is a purple state. And the representation in the legislature does not prove that. Because you've got all the conservative issues being passed through with no problem. And then, you know, voting access.
No, Pennsylvania's got its problems too. Look, you know, where I'm at, in 2018, they did a mock-up of who got what. And, you know, Democrats got 54% of the vote across the state. Democrats won the state row offices. They had big numbers, yet only got 45% of the seats in the House and the Senate. You know, same thing with Michigan. Michigan, you saw 53% of the vote going to Democrats, but they only got 47% of the seats. Even North Carolina. North Carolina was a blue state. 51% voted for Democrats. Only 45% of the people got an actual representative. So we don't have representative democracy, and I'm not going into that. But when it's that skewed and you're getting that little representation, like here in Pennsylvania, the Democrats won the popular vote and got 8 to 13 seats. It was something crazy, like way out of the realm of possibility.
Right. Yeah. And then you look at that and you see that the certain issues, no matter what the opinion is, they're going to pass the issues the way they want to. I also cover abortion because I cover all these non-controversial topics. I cover abortion too. And they, you know, the abortion, the Pew Research Center said that abortion in the state, the opinion as to whether it be legal or not is about split, but 49% think that abortion should be legal in most cases, if not all. And that's not how we see the legislature voting. We see them pushing through 6-week bans. We see them pushing through all sorts of things. And education is the same way. We see different private school ed choice scholarships going through when that may not be 90% of the students that are in schools are in public schools in this state. So it's definitely a way to sway things the way you want to look at it.
Yeah, and ultimately it comes back to what my high school government teacher said. Government's about who gets what. And, right. You know, the moneyed interests have spent lots of money making sure that the Republicans right now remain in power. And because they're the ones getting what they want, the average everyday working stiff is getting the short end of the stick again and again and again. And I understand why people are angry. I do. I understand why folks feel like their government is letting them down, that they're not getting what they should be getting out of policy or initiatives, because they're not.
Right. And absolutely. And that's definitely something that we try to continue to push, is that people should have their voice, and we're trying to make sure that their voices come out in this redistricting thing and education and anything. Make sure that we get the people talking and not just the stiffs, as you call them.
I'm a working stiff.
Yeah. We got to get the non-administrative stiffs and the working stiffs instead.
So real quick, last prediction. Will there be a really funny cartoon to come out of these maps? Will there be something outrageous?
Absolutely. We've already seen things that look like tie-dye, things that look like a swirl, like a Dairy Queen swirl, and things like that. Yeah. There will be some pretty ones.
At least we can mock it, even if it means we're swirling down the drain. But Susan, I appreciate you taking some time. I look forward to your reporting on this, and I hope you'll come back again and talk to us real soon.
Absolutely. Been a great time, Rick.
Good stuff. Thanks so much, Susan Tebben, reporter there at the Ohio Capital Journal. Make sure you check out their website, ohiocapitaljournal.com. We'll get links out on social media. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
This day in labor history, the year was 1941. The ravages of World War II had swept across Europe. German troops had invaded Norway in April of 1940. The conditions of the Nazi occupation grew increasingly harsher. The Nazis began rationing milk, an important part of the diet of Norwegian children and workers. The rationing, however, did not apply to the German occupiers. Angered shipyard workers in Oslo walked off the job in protest. Workers from other industries joined them. 20,000 workers from 50 factories and work sites participated in the strike. The Nazi response to the uprising was predictably swift and brutal. 200 labor leaders were arrested, and new Nazi chosen leaders put in their places. 27 of the arrested labor leaders and strikers were brought before a court-martial trial. Rolf Wickstrom, a welder and union steward, and Harald Viggo Hansteen, a labor lawyer, were sentenced to death for their involvement in the strike and executed. The remaining 25 strikers were convicted and sentenced to long prison sentences. Ludwig Bulin, a Union railway worker, died while serving his prison sentence. So did Harry Vesely, a factory worker. Journalists were fired or arrested. Even groups like the Boy Scouts were banned. Listening to foreign broadcasts on the radio were expressly forbidden. Then, radios were confiscated. In Sweden, trade unionists issued this statement in support of their fellow Scandinavian workers. They wrote, quote, "Norwegian trade unionists have fallen in the battle for Norway's freedoms and for the right of the Norwegian working class to decide for itself its own actions with the limits of Norwegian law. We honor their memory." In 1948, a memorial was placed to honor the deaths of Wickstrom and Hansteen and the workers who stood up for their country. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So with 9/11 coming up this weekend and all the memories that will be drudged up because of, well, 20 years after, one of the things I hope we spend a little bit of time on is thinking about what America used to be like 20 years ago today, instead of 20 years ago on Saturday, because we knew on 9/11, we knew the world was never going to be the same. We knew that. We knew life as we knew it was over. And a friend of mine, you may remember Victoria, she said, you know, now you're going to get to learn what we've been dealing with in the UK for years because of terrorism. You're going to, you know, the loss of privacy is going to be huge. And how are you guys going to deal with it? And I remember being shocked at how willing people were at that time to go, yeah, take it. I just want to be safe. But here to share some thoughts on, well, the 20th, I hate to say anniversary because that sounds positive, the 20th memorial, I guess, of the country we once knew. I've asked Will Bunch to come talk with us. Will's a national columnist over at the Philadelphia Daily News. He's got a piece out. We knew America would never be the same after 9/11. We didn't know how bad. Will, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah. Hey, Rick, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
I agree. We knew it was going to be different. We knew life was over as we knew it. I didn't know it was going to be this bad either.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I mean, it all started on that crazy day. Right. And, you know, I remember, I mean, we didn't know for sure. I mean, it's hard to believe now, but, you know, as 9/11 was unfolding and that afternoon when people were trying to make sense of it, we still didn't know who had done the attacks. To be honest, people forget that most Americans didn't even know who Osama bin Laden was on the morning of September 11th, 2001. And yet what struck me as being so crazy about that day is, you know, you had all these like members of Congress going on TV and saying, well, we're at war now. And I'm thinking like, at war with who? And I guess it's turned out over 20 years, we've been at war with almost everybody, you know? I mean, when you look at the de-evolution, for want of a better term, of how this went down, I was one of those people. I mean, when they invaded Afghanistan 6 weeks or whatever after the attacks, I'm extremely anti-war. I'm not like a total pacifist. I mean, I believe if you can come up with some kind of legitimate self-defense argument that, and so they said, well, if we're going to try and catch bin Laden, if we're going to try and eliminate a haven for the terrorists who actually attacked this country, and if it's a short-term operation, I could not be opposed to that, you know. But, you know, within a year, here we are talking about invading Iraq, a country that had nothing to do with 9/11. I mean, that whole experience is really what radicalized me. I mean, I was probably a center leftist at the start of the 2000s, you know, I was really radicalized by the fact that we would come up with this fake cause for war. And also I was kind of disgusted with my own profession, the media, for the way that we didn't stand up to that. But, you know, I mean, so we went, that was the next phase. And in the meantime, it was just a slippery slope to, the way that our leaders mined paranoia and fear and suspicion and just turned it against people, you know, then it was turned against immigrants, you know, and the Republican Party became the anti-immigrant party. And, you know, then this whole Homeland Security regime, you know, these small town police departments started buying armored personnel carriers. And, you know, and it was inevitable that these would be turned against people in this country protesting, which is exactly what you saw at Ferguson and these other places. And as I say in the story, I mean, I really think there's a line, you know, that the actual 9/11 terrorists from Al Qaeda wanted to take down the Capitol Dome with that last flight 93, and they failed. But 20 years later, the Capitol Dome was breached by a different kind of radicals, you know, and Osama bin Laden really couldn't have drawn it up any better. You know, they wanted the U.S. to come apart at the seams, to come apart internally. And by giving in to our worst impulses, that's pretty much exactly what we've done this last 20 years.
No, I remember, George W. Bush going, they hate us for our freedoms. And I remember at the time saying, I don't know why, because you're taking them. It made no sense to me to go, this is what they hate us for, so let's limit what that is. And now we're in this moment where we've got a surveillance state that is all around us. They're constantly, new technologies coming online to invade our privacy, to get inside of our heads, to track us, to follow us, to all of this stuff. And you go, it all came out of that, I hate to sound conspiratorial, but the Project for a New American Century was right. We need a Pearl Harbor type event to do all of the things we've always dreamt of doing. Yeah. And these last 20 years have been the right wing wet dream.
Yeah. I'm so glad you used that word conspiratorial, because I was just going to open my mouth and make that exact same point, which is that's a whole nother aspect of this, which is, you know, when people say, oh, Americans are so conspiracy minded, you know, well, it started with our leaders lying to us nonstop for, you know, several years about, you know, and you know, I mean, 9/11 obviously was done by Osama bin Laden and Al Qaeda. And when you talk about 9/11, you should never forget, you know, their evil and their evil motivations, which are true. But, they're starting on the day of 9/11, there were things that the government started, our government, the U.S. government, started lying to us about. And it just got progressively worse, you know, with this phony case that Saddam Hussein was making nuclear bombs, that he was, which he wasn't, that, you know, that he was harboring members of Al Qaeda, which he wasn't. That he had weapons of mass destruction hidden all over the country, which he didn't. That he was, not letting the weapons inspectors into his country, which he was. And, can you blame citizens for having a lack of trust after those lies? And like you said, I mean, I don't want that part of the history, you know, the Project for a New America and the talk of a new Pearl Harbor. I mean, I don't think that should ever be forgotten when it gets dropped from the story too many times. But, there was a cadre of people in the U.S. government who wanted to exploit situations for their own agenda. And their own agenda was, control the oil producing regions of the world. You know, that we have to do whatever it takes to make sure that this oil spigot is open. And that's the thing when you talk about 20 years later. I mean, knowing what we know now, it's not just that, you know, even if oil was the most wonderful, you know, even if oil was like a cure for cancer, you know, it would still be immoral to kill people so that we could control all the oil. But that's not what oil is. Oil is a fossil fuel that's strangling the planet. And, you know, our whole strategy was based on controlling the region so we would have more access to this substance that's actually kind of destroying planet Earth. You know, it's just a horrible situation. And 9/11 could have been a time for America to reflect on its role in the world. You know, there's certainly wonderful things about this country that we could market ourselves around the world, and instead of trying to convince people to come to our side by dropping bombs on them. But you know, we didn't have that period of self-reflection after 9/11. Instead, we wanted to prove that we were still this exceptional country, and we had to prove it, you know, with militarism.
And ours is bigger than yours. Listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're with Will Bunch. He's a national columnist for the Philadelphia Daily News. His most recent piece out, We Knew America Would Never Be the Same After 9/11, But We Didn't Know How Bad, written by Will Bunch. We'll get links out on social media. But, you know, here's where my mind is, you know, on this 20th, memorial. I want to go back and I want to know who got us into all of this stuff. I've got a friend who was in Congress at the time, and he says, I can't tell you how they lied us into these wars. I can't reveal to you what was told to us, and you would have voted for it too. Because it's easy to blame the politicians. It's easy to blame the people who voted to get us into these wars, because they were lied to as well. We've never held those people accountable, not even a little bit. And at some point, don't we have to go back and dig? I know the old saying, let the sleeping dogs lie, but don't we have to wake those dogs up and hold them accountable at some point?
Oh, absolutely. You know, and I thought it was very interesting that Biden announced this week that he is declassifying some of these documents from 9/11. You know, it'll be interesting to see. I mean, I'm always a little bit dubious, I'm still waiting on the JFK assassination papers that they promised would be released.
Aren't we all?
Yeah, right. So, and that was 50 years earlier, right? So I don't know, but you know, I mean, because there are questions about the role of Saudi Arabia. You know, that's I know the families. It's tragic, these families who lost loved ones on 9/11, and they feel that. Many of them feel that they've been lied to, you know, because they have. But many of them feel they haven't been told the whole truth about Saudi Arabia's role in all of this.
And well, we know 11 of the 19 hijackers were Saudi nationals.
I think it was 11 or was it 15? It was at least 11.
It was somewhere
in the double digits. But we continued to like beg and grovel and kneel to Saudi Arabia. And we attack this other nation, Iraq, that has nothing to do with it. I mean that alone just has to raise all sorts of questions in my mind. I would love to see, you know, I mean, you know, I guess the argument is that we had a 9/11 commission and they did uncover a few things, but I'm with you, Rick. I don't think we know everything there is about 9/11, and hopefully in our lifetime, new facts will come up. But then, of course, like I said, I'm still thinking that about the JFK assassination. So,
no, and this is where, you know, I know, you know, as we're coming closer to, I'm going to have a whole bunch of people then, you know, beating me up for not believing that this was an inside job, that, you know, that George Bush was planting thermite all over the place.
Oh.
Look, I don't think he could have planned a picnic at the zoo, let alone something of this magnitude. I could be wrong, but I don't think it was George W. Bush.
Yeah, right. I mean, if they were that good at planning things, they would have planted weapons of mass destruction in Iraq and say, see, we found them, right? You know. I agree with you. I think there are plenty of legitimate questions about 9/11, you know, why we were so badly prepared. You know, we supposedly had the greatest air defense system in the world, but we didn't really have planes in the air when it counted. I think it's legitimate to ask all those questions. We had dodgy relationships with a lot of countries. We had dodgy relationships with Pakistan, which is really the country that is behind the Taliban, certainly, and a company that has links to Al-Qaeda. There are many unanswered questions. I guess part of the problem is, new bad things keep happening. And it's like, you know, at some point, it's like we're trying to figure out what happened on January 6th. So who has the resources to figure out what happened 20 years ago on 9/11? We should. Hopefully, you know, I think journalism has a role to play in that. I know there's still journalists out there writing books and investigating that day. It's only been 20 years, you know. It's important because really in my lifetime, you know, I can't think of any other day that's changed the direction of the country.
No, you're right. And the direction of our lives as well. I mean, the reality is you know, I remember as a kid being able to go to the airport and just walk through the metal detector and watch the planes, just as a kid, watch the planes take off and come and go. Now everybody's got to take their shoes off. We've created this surveillance state, this security state that I don't know that we can undo the horrible things we did through the Patriot Act and the Department of Homeland Security, which is the third largest cabinet position in our government. There's a problem here, Will.
Yeah, I mean, the Department of Homeland Security, the whole thing was basically a mistake. Starting with the name, is terrible. When they set up the Department of Homeland Security and when they created ICE, you know, people who were experts on immigration tried to warn us back 18, 19 years ago, you know, that ICE is a mistake, that this is going to become a kind of a secret police force on immigration that's going to, you know, wield powers that you don't want them to wield. And, you know, people weren't really paying attention until 3 or 4 years ago when we realized we had this force that was basically snatching people out of churches and taking their kids to school, you know, and, you know, and tearing families apart at the southern border.
And doing all kinds of horrible things. But here.
Yeah. And those things, you know, I mean, people, I don't know if you remember a couple of years ago, there was this viral video of a debate between Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush in I guess it was the 1980 presidential campaign, talking about immigration. And, you know, and these aren't the two greatest human beings in American history, but they were actually, you know, fairly compassionate. And, you know, they talked about letting people in. And of course, Ronald Reagan did an amnesty for immigration. We did not view illegal immigration as a crime before 9/11.
But we didn't view it as illegal. I mean, you're even using their words.
I'm sorry. Yeah, I apologize for that. We did not view the arrival of undocumented non-citizens. But the reality is
neither Bush, H.W. Bush, or Ronald Reagan would be recognizable in today's Republican Party. They wouldn't get elected dog catcher.
Yeah, and to say that about Reagan in particular is incredible. We've gone in our lifetime from that night in 1980 when Reagan was elected, and I was a senior in college, and I'll never forget it. I remember throwing beer cans at the TV, and I thought, yeah, this was the end of America as we know it. And now, you know, if you had to choose between a Reagan or a Trump or even a George W. Bush, you know, you would take Reagan back in a heartbeat.
You know? So last question I've got for you, you know, with September 11th, you know, coming up very quickly, what will you do? What's your memory? What do you normally do on that day?
That's a great question. I'll watch some of the remembrances on TV, and, you know, I have a lot of memories about that day, about, you know, I was a dad with two young children, I had a new puppy. We were trying to train our new puppy. And I remember seeing the attacks at home because it was early in the morning, as you remember, and knowing I'd have to go into the newsroom and work for 14 hours and probably write the main story, which I did. And, you know, just sitting out there under a tree with our new puppy on this beautiful 85 degree, you know, total sunshine day, and think about this horrible thing that had happened just 100 miles away, and just the contrast, and, you know, and thinking about having two young children, and what was I going to tell them about a world where something like this could happen, and that was sad enough, and you know, the things that we've been talking about how that tragedy was manipulated for other bad things for 20 years is just heartbreaking.
I'm right there with you, Will. I appreciate the time and the work that you do. Keep it up. Look forward to having you get back again real soon.
Yeah, Rick, thanks for having me on again, as always.
Good stuff.
Appreciate it.
Our good friend Will Bunch. Make sure you check out his work over at the Philadelphia Daily Press, where he's a national columnist. The most recent piece, "We Knew America Would Never Be the Same After 9/11, But We Didn't Know How Bad." We'll get links out on social media. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You can listen to The Rick Smith Show.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
Hey, podcast fans, have you heard about MSW Media? It's your one-stop shop for some of the best progressive voices in the business. At MSWmedia.com, you'll find shows like Justice Matters with Glenn Kirshner, The Bureau with Frank Figluzzi, shows with hosts like Greg O'Lear and Zev Shalev, and of course, Renato Mariotti, just to name a few. One of our personal favorites, The Daily Beans with Dr. Allison Gill. And of course, you can get The Rick Smith Show there too. Go to MSWmedia.com for all these great shows and more, and help us push back against the right-wing hate machine one download at a time.